Today's text is John chapter 13. I apologize that our weekly devotional this past week did not reflect that. I cut things off too early in what you read. So you might get some surprise verses here if you're one who prepares for our sermon with the weekly devotional. Hear now the word of the Lord. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, "Not all of you are clean." When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me, the one who sent me." After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at table close to Jesus. So Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. So that disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is he whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it." So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, "What you are going to do, do quickly." Now no one at the table knew why he had said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, "Buy what we need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. When he had gone out, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me. And just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered him, Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Jesus answered, Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, I want to give you guys some things to think about so that when you for the whole sermon, you can be thinking about what God teaches us. Because that's for everybody, right? Kids and adults need to think about those things together. So I want to ask you a question. Do you guys like to play outside in the summertime with bare feet? Are you allowed to play outside in bare feet? I don't know. Do you like to play around in the mud? Do you like to jump in muddy puddles? Yeah. If you're playing outside in bare feet in the mud and you come running back inside because you want to get a drink, what does mom or dad say to you before you come in? Wait, 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 wait. Don't come in here with those feet. Wash those feet off, right? Because if you come in with the messy feet, what happens? Messy rug, messy floor, and not so happy mom or dad, right? So you got to wash those feet off or it gets really messy. Well, in today's story, did you hear when I was reading that Jesus was washing the disciples' feet? That was a yucky thing to do. Do you want to wash somebody else's yucky feet? No way. Back then, it was a really yucky thing to do. And Jesus did it anyway because he wanted them to see that sin, the mean and selfish things that we do, is kind of like dirt or mud. And then Jesus said, unless he washes us, he says, we have no share with him. That might not be clear. What that meant was, we won't be able to receive all the things he's going to give us. And that means being saved and going to heaven with God forever. We have to be washed, he says. And he doesn't mean you have to take a bath to go to heaven. That would be silly, wouldn't it? He means that he has to clean us from our sin. And he doesn't do that with a bath. He did that by dying for us, right? Taking our punishment for us. And rising again so that we could live again someday too. That's a lot to think about, I know. It's even a lot for adults to think about. But I want you to try to think about that as we're going through the rest of the sermon, okay? All right, thank you for listening. Well, in today's text, John again went out of his way to make sure we knew that it's still near the Passover. You're used to this by now, right? John barely tells a single story without putting it in the context of some Jewish feast or celebration to pinpoint that Christ is the ultimate answer of all these hopes and desires that those feasts pointed to. But he's mentioning it again, even though he just mentioned it in the previous text, because he wants to remind us that all the symbolism of Passover, the Passover lamb dying for the people, not to free them just from the Egyptians, but to free them from God's hand of justice. That imagery needs to still be informing everything that he's going to talk about here. So please keep that shadow of Passover that we talked about last week kind of cast over everything we see here. And I say shadow, it almost sounds like it's a bad thing. It's a good thing, okay? It is reminding us that everything needs to be seen in light of this. And so here we have, in preparation for the Passover, this meal they're eating. Now, this is not, don't get bogged down with the differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke and John. It's hard to understand exactly how the chronology plays out, and it's not important. As Calvin said, I leave this to a later generation of Christians to solve. And he moved on. And if you look at Calvin's complete works from the floor, they're stacked up to about here. That doesn't mean he's right, but it does mean he's not lazy. Okay? He's not anti-intellectual, okay? So, I want to say that to encourage you. We don't understand exactly how the chronology plays out. Don't get bogged down with that. Get bogged down right now with what is being communicated here very clearly. It's not hard to understand what he's preaching to us here. In verse 1, in this beautiful, beautiful discussion there, it says that Christ, knowing his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And the Greek word there for end can have numerous meanings, as our word end can as well. The end can mean what's your goal, or it can mean the duration is over, okay? And many of you know from Bible studies or lessons that I've taught, I get really annoyed when commentators cop out and say, ah, it means both, when often, no, it doesn't. You're just, you know, copping out here. All right, well, I think John might mean both here, okay? That the goal is what? Finishing out the entire mission. And so going for the duration of all he's required to do, it's hard enough to leave the Father's side and be born in the womb of one of your creatures, to be tended to by them, to suffer in a sin-broken world, in a sin-broken body, when you didn't commit any of those sins, for 33 years, no less. That's hard enough, being king of the universe. But what he's about to do puts all that makes all that look like nothing, what he's about to go through. And so he is going to give them a foreshadowing, as he's done with all of his miracles, of what he's going to accomplish for them. And so he is going to love them to the uttermost, which means finishing this mission. And he shows them just how drastic his mission is. If you look there in verse 3, I love the crazy juxtaposition, or just maybe surprise, between verses 3 and 4. Look at the ramp up here at verse 3. Jesus, knowing the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, that's when he's about to do something what? He's going to blow the lid off something, right? I've got all the authority. I'm going back to God. I'm going to lay aside my outer garment, take a towel and tie it around my waist and wash your feet. Do you see that crazy disjointedness with those two verses? It can't leap off the page enough, because you shouldn't have expected that even from a peer, let alone your rabbi, let alone God. And this is one of the ways in which he's loving them to the uttermost. Not meaning he left the Father's throne to come wash some feet, but he's letting them know, again, after the triumphal or not so triumphal entries we talked about last week, of the gentle, humble king, the one who's not coming in on a high-trotting war horse to whip the people into a frenzy, but comes in on a donkey's colt, weeping once he sees the city because he knows what's going to befall her for her rejection. That is actually how he's bringing this kingdom. And so what is the kind of kingdom he's bringing? He's showing them here. This is still an extended lesson on what it means to be the gentle, humble king of a gentle, humble kingdom. And so he loves them to the utmost and does something they would not have dared to do. And I think sometimes we may view their shock and Peter's, you know, embarrassment at what Jesus is doing by thinking, oh, they're so ashamed that they didn't think to do this first and Jesus had to be the one to go do it. Kind of like you feel bad when your guest comes over and they ask you for a drink. Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't offer that first. And that's really far from what's going on here. I don't know if you ever experienced someone you look up to, someone who you revere, all of a sudden doing something far beneath their dignity, and just you get hot and sweaty with embarrassment. They're disgusted by what he's doing here. Is the best way to understand it. They're not embarrassed that they didn't do it first. They wouldn't have done it. No, peers don't wash each other's feet. This is the lowliest of low servant tasks. So you go without your feet being washed rather than go do it yourself. It's too demeaning. And so when they see Jesus doing this, they're horrified. And you almost get the idea that there's almost righteous indignation in what Peter's doing, not in the sense that he realizes, no, I should be doing this for you. It's like, just stop. What are you doing? You're not going to wash my feet. And Peter is right on one sense. Christ is doing something totally improper. Not sinning. He's not breaking God's law, okay? But this is not what should be done. It's just not right by their cultural standards. We go without not having you do this. And good old Peter, I'm sorry that I chuckled during the reading. I'm not trying to make light of Scripture, but you just can't. Talk about mood swings. This guy is just, you know, crest and trough if you're charting out what his life looks like. In one breath, his response to Christ as, well, let me back up. Christ's words to him are, Peter, if you don't allow me to wash you, you have no share with me. And that language there is often, almost always associated with inheritance language. So the idea is, if you don't let me wash you, you do not share in the inheritance that I'm earning for you. All that I'm going to give as my kingdom, you must be washed to share in all those things. And if not, you're out. And what Christ is communicating there is something that many of us, I think, struggle with. Whether we specifically verbalize it or not, you have to really humble yourself to receive the gospel. And we know that. That's why the gospel is called offensive by Paul, called a stumbling block by Paul, called foolishness. Not because it's actually those things, but people who like to think that they aren't the worst thing in the world don't want to hear that maybe they are. People who like to think that we're better than other people. People who like to think, well, the reason I'm a Christian is because I don't want to live these horrible lives. It's often offensive to us to hear that you don't just need advice and help. You need it to be done for you completely. You can't contribute at all to your salvation. And we say that often, but I think when push comes to shove, we don't like it owning just how helpless we are before God our Father. And I've used this analogy with you before, but if any of you have had to work with loved ones who are nearing the end of their life and have to consign themselves to permanent assistance, whether it's a wheelchair, whatever else, you see them rage against that. They don't want to own that they have to rely on this now. They don't want to give up in that sense. And I think we experience something of that, but with no good motives, okay? It's not valiant to fight against that, okay? And so often I think we're offended when we hear that we need to let Jesus do everything for us. Not meaning he does your believing for you, he does your trying for you, but that my efforts are so poor that I need to be credited with his because none of mine would ever cut it. And instead of being offended, why would we not just receive that as the greatest news ever? That he's willing to do that for me. And there are times when we do. And we can attest to how sweet those times are when we realize, why would I get up in arms about this with offense? Why not just receive this amazing, amazing food that Christ has given me to eat? Flip side, though, I think the non-believer is also very offended. What do you mean I deserve a death sentence? What do you mean? Sure, I'm not perfect, but so what? Who is? And so non-believer and believer alike need to ask the Lord for the humility to accept Christ, the King of Kings, coming down in servant form to wash my feet. But if I don't receive his dying for me, the ultimate act of humble service, and not just humble, let's call it humiliating service. If I'm not willing to accept that that's how bad my needs are, then I don't have any part in him. I can't receive his inheritance. Thankfully, for each of us who believe, he broke down the door of rebellion for us and led us to receiving that. That's why we must always thank him that he was willing to do that for us and didn't wait for us to all of a sudden come to our senses on our own, but met us while we were his enemies and brought us to himself. And it's why we cannot give up vigilantly praying for those who are still apart from him, for him to do the same thing for them. So it is scandalous what he's done, both in washing feet and far more in coming to earth to die our death. It is scandalous, it is improper, and it's our only hope. So after this, he tells Peter, no, I don't need to go ahead and wash your head and your hands. Yes, you're responding as you typically do. Those who have been washed don't need to be cleansed except for their feet. And you are clean. He says, but not all of you. He's going to lead into those who's going to betray him. But what he's telling us there is the idea that leading into the example for us, we've been clean and our actions are never going to go clean anybody else. Christ has cleaned us. But we are required to go ahead and wash the feet of others. Now, some denominations out there take that literally and they've made it even a sacrament where you must practice foot washing ceremonies. I'm guessing I'm not alone in the fact that you're glad we don't do that here. But if God had told us to, we'd have to do it with joy, right? He has not. It's obviously an analogy. Do the express this kind of love for others that I am sharing with you. And so he specifically says in verses 12 through 17, how we're to respond to this. And in verse 15, he says specifically, I've given you an example that you should do as I do. And he says, and don't weasel out of this, okay? If I, your teacher and Lord, have done this for you, how dare you say you don't have to do it for others? I can't imagine how their world was just being turned upside down. I mean, that's often when Jesus is speaking. That's happening for his audience. But they are so shocked that he would do this, and now this has to be par for the course for us? What? You're crazy. And Christ said, by the way, I know you're not going to get this now, and it's going to take a while. But I think often, if you're anything like me, if you are used to hearing from the broad evangelical world that Jesus is only ever your example, that he's not your substitute, often times when the text is pointing out that he should be your example, you might even recoil. You might even ignore it, put it on the back burner, whatever else. And I do think it is crucial that we not cave into the broad evangelical idea that Jesus is first and foremost an example, because if that's all he is, all of us are doomed, right? And there's nothing distinctively Christian about viewing Jesus as an example. Very few religions have a problem with Jesus as an example. No, first and foremost, he must be Savior and substitute, and then example. However, just because example follows in that place doesn't mean we can ignore it or take it lightly. And Christ is very clearly saying, do not miss what I have done here. I have just given you an example. And if I, your teacher, did this for you, then you really must do this for others. And he's putting it here as a hallmark of what life as his ambassadors for his kingdom is going to look like. Paul could not be clearer. Don't turn there because I'm actually reading from the NIV because it's a clearer translation. Listen to Paul in 1 Corinthians. Many of you guys have this one memorized. Philippians 2. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Paul clearly said, your attitude should be the same as that. And I think that is beneath all of us in some way, shape, or form. Many of us get energized by hearing Christianity is this cause generator, right? And we'll sign up for a grand crusade or cause of some sort. Lay it on the line. Devote hours. Take the persecution in the press. Because Christianity is about this cause. Let's do it. But a kingdom that is saying, one of my primary marching orders for you is that, yes, you proclaim my good news, but you gain audiences and opportunities for that by serving others like this. Who's signing up for that? Not many of us. And please don't hear me pointing a finger or hear me accusing you as though I am one who's mastered this. So what it comes down to is, I think many of us, unlike even our text today that we preached and read for our confession of faith, confession of sin from Romans 12, we don't look for opportunities to serve. We may do what we have to do because it comes before us and the consequences are too painful if we don't go ahead and serve in these fashions. But that's often when we are doing it out of begrudging duty, which then doesn't count as obedience at all before God, because obedience is loving him with heart, soul, mind, strength. So if I'm serving bitterly, yes, I might be making the situation better than had I not served, but I'm certainly not loving God at all, therefore I'm not obeying him and I'm not glorifying him. And so I would ask each of us to just think of the situations God has put us in, the people God has put in our lives, and perhaps meditate for a second on who currently doesn't qualify to be served by you. Who's currently beneath your service? Not worth it. I'm not pretending I know who it is for you. I know who it is for me. And no one else, not any of you. If people are in that category in your life, not being worth your time or your effort or your love, how exactly do they disqualify themselves? What did they do to all of a sudden not be worth your love and service? Did they find a way to out-traitor Judas in your life? Probably not. I don't think it's possible for anyone to do to you what Judas has done to Christ. Yes, you can be betrayed, maybe even with more vengeance than Judas had towards Christ, but the consequences cannot outdo what that betrayal did for Christ. And Christ knew he was going to do that, and Judas's feet are just as clean as anybody else's in this story when he's done. And so if it was unthinkable to them for even a peer to wash a peer's feet, how much more unthinkable is it for Christ, God of the universe, to wash the feet of a mortal enemy and do it with joy? I know often this text is preached at, whose feet have you washed lately? Whose feet haven't you washed lately? Get out there and do a better job. And Jesus' model here is only used as a guilt trip. And that's the last thing it should be. However, this passage should be greatly convicting. But conviction of sin will not change us and make us love God more. But it will uncover things, sinful patterns in our lives that have had the luxury of remaining covered up for too long. And so let these words penetrate into our hearts and ask the Lord that beyond today's text, I mean today's sermon, today's service, that these words continue to convict. Who are we not loving? Who are we not serving? And how can we begin to change that? Conviction alone, feeling guilty alone, will not change that the right way. It might make you start to serve them, but you'll still be embittered about it. Or you'll begin keeping score, keeping track, and then patting yourself on the back and sending yourself into a spiral of self-righteousness, which is so destructive. So it's very important that we see in this next section where our motivation comes from. Because in verse 18, Christ begins saying, with great trouble in his spirit, the text says, one of you is going to betray me. And why do we need to have that in this text? It already told us in the beginning, Christ knew. Well, he reiterates it, A, because we're all slow. B, they needed to hear it specifically because if they hadn't heard these things, you might be led to think that Christ didn't see this coming, that God himself was somehow surprised, ambushed, and headed off in the past, and all of a sudden his plans for a kingdom were thwarted. Anyone who's been listening to anything Jesus has been saying shouldn't go there. He's been saying over and over again, I came to die, I came to die, I came to die. I'm going to give my life, I'm going to give my life. And even here now with this, you see they're still like, what? What do you mean? And still didn't get it. But he said in verse 19, I'm telling you this now before it takes place so that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. So the point of this is you're going to see me destroyed, humanly speaking, lifted up and killed. And when that happens, I want that to strengthen your faith, not destroy it. By letting you know, I know everything that's happening. I am showing you I'm sovereign over all this. I'm giving myself over to these people. They're not taking my life from me. So when you see me persecuted and killed, remember, I'm sovereign over all this. This is my plan. It should strengthen your faith in me, not destroy it. But by going into highlighting, I know how deep the treachery goes in you, Judas Iscariot. It should leap off the page all the more that he was willing to wash, yes, even Judas's feet, to serve even a Judas like that. And if indeed this washing of the feet is supposed to be a foretaste of the ultimate humiliation of dying our traitor's death for us on the cross, which again, we know it is. Christ said, Peter, if I don't wash you, you have no part in me. You have no share in me. So it's supposed to be a picture of what he's going to do. If that's the case, then how much more should we see ourselves with our lot thrown in with people just like Judas? Every one of the disciples, by the end, falls away. They all desert. And as our text came around at the very end to remind us, even Peter, who's going to lay down his life for Christ, is going to deny him three times before the sun even comes up. So we have to see when he's talking about, yes, one of you is going to betray me. True, Judas is going to go farther than the rest. But every one of us has it in us to do the same thing. And every one of our sins is an act of rebellion and blasphemy and treason. So we have to throw our lot in with him and the rest of these guys who desert and say he's willing to wash even their feet. He's willing to wash even mine. Because every one of us was an enemy, not just blind and helpless though we are, but it goes beyond that. Romans 5, 7 through 10. What does Paul say? For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person, one would dare even to die. Just the idea, a good person there means a benefactor. So people won't normally die even for a righteous person, but maybe if someone had been a huge benefactor to you, maybe then, Paul grants, you might be willing to lay down your life for someone who had been very kind to you. But God shows his love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God? Listen to verse 10. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, how much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life? So when we were saved, when God came to us to offer us that life, we were not simply going the wrong way. We were not simply blind. We were not simply weak. We were dead and we were enemies of him. Just like Judas. And yet for some reason he chose to show us mercy. We can't lose track of that. And that's where your motivation comes to wash the feet of others. If he has washed the feet of a traitor and died my traitor's death, then I get to show thankfulness to him. I get to love him when I shouldn't even had the opportunity to love him. I should have been killed for my crimes and rejected forever. He lets me become his adopted child, and I get to love someone who loves like that. And he's asked me, because he doesn't need his feet to be washed. He doesn't need anything from us, but all those around us need great, great things. Their needs are huge. And he said, love me by loving them. And I've shown you how. Be willing to go to the utmost for them, even if it defies convention. And so we hear that section closes in verse 30. It's been a theme John's been tracing all throughout from chapter 1. He tells Judas, what you're going to do, go do quickly. And he went out, and the text says, one of the most profound understatements of the whole Bible, it was night. Don't miss that. Lightness and darkness, night and day have been big themes John's been tracing. And the picture we get here is that all the forces of darkness are now amassing for their onslaught because they think it's time to win. Victory is at hand. It's night. And I love how Christ responds in the very next verse. It was night. And what's Jesus' words? Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. He's not worried one bit about what the powers of darkness might do. Instead, he's going to move forward with all confidence, knowing that God has promised him it will be complete. As Isaiah prophesies, the Messiah will set his face like flint and not be moved. And it's so important to remember, why does he have such resolve to do this for us? Why is he able to move forward against all the powers of darkness? Don't say because he was God. It's true that he's God, but that's not the answer. Why is he able to move forward like this in the face of Satan and all his forces? Is because he tried really hard. As a human, he loved God so much. He trusted in those promises so well that all the amassed forces of evil in the universe were nothing to him. And that's the obedience that you and I have been credited with. That's where your resolve comes from, remembering it. That's how he loves me. That's how he delights in me. When I cave in so many times, when I refuse to even represent the gospel well because I'm afraid of a funny look somebody might give me, and I get credited with standing up before the entire powers of darkness with confidence in God's promises, yes, then I want to love someone who's going to give me a gift like that. And so his response to all of what's going on here is to summarize all that he's just demonstrated to them and all he's about to demonstrate even more powerfully in a few days on the cross. When he says to them, which might sound odd to you, in verse 34, a new command I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you also are to love one another. What's so new about that? Haven't we known that for a while? Not actually. In the Old Testament, and even here in the New, how is it summarized how we should love each other? Love your neighbor as yourself, right? And Christ, by going to the utmost culturally, being willing to go ahead and wash their feet, went beyond loving your neighbor as yourself. And he's saying, I'm upping the ante. I'm ratcheting up the requirements. I want you to know just how much I love you, and I want you to do the same. Love one another as I have loved you, more than you love yourself, just as Paul said. Consider others better than yourself. Paul says it in Romans as well, Romans 12. That's the whole response to everything in the first 11 chapters. Consider others as more important than yourself. Love them as Christ has loved. That's the new command. And it's going to take a whole lot more power from him to be moved like that to love others. It's going to take him dying in our place, living in our place, rising in our place, and giving us the power of the risen Christ with the Holy Spirit in our hearts to move us to love like that. And so as he said to Peter, I've cleansed you. My work on the cross will cleanse you once and for all. And I'm going to do that for everybody else. I'm not calling you to go do things that cleanse other people. Our response to the gospel never equals the gospel. But he has said, however, the people who are cleansed still need their feet washed. And I'm calling you guys to go do that. You're all clean. But a new command I give you. I just demonstrated to you the kind of love you should show, and I want you to go do that for the world. And that is the marching orders of the gentle, humble king who rides in on a donkey. In his bizarre plan, contrary to all the wisdom of the world, he is going to take over the world, not using one single earthly weapon, not using one single piece of earthly legislation. He's going to arm a bunch of people who look as ridiculous as the apostles did as far as an army that's going to take over the world. He's going to arm them in their weakness with a message of hope that them, with their broken speech, are going to nevertheless utter. And they're going to gain audiences for this message with a radical kind of love. They're willing to show each other. That's how people will know you are mine. You're going to love each other, but you're going to go one better. You're going to love those on the outside, and you're going to love even your enemies this way. And we know from the story of church history, it's exactly what happened. As they love persecutor after persecutor changes. That does not come easily. And it often is going to be the last thing we want to do. And it's in those moments when we begin listing all our reasons why I don't have to serve, why it's somebody else's job, why I've already done too much, why can't somebody else step up? If I serve, it'll just enable others not to do anything. I can't play that role. So I best better do nothing. And every other excuse we give ourselves. Remembering what has been done for us. And when Christ says, if I, your Lord and teacher, have done this for you, not just in washing feet, but in dying your traitor's death for you, who are we to hold back? And I'm not trying to guilt anybody into doing anything today. What I want us all to realize is, first of all, if he loves me that much, I want to ask him to help me begin to serve, to respond to that grace, knowing that he's not going to love me on how well I serve. He loves me on how well Christ served in my place. So I have nothing to fear. And if I go forward and try to serve and I fail, that failure is paid for too. So I can get up, not be attacked by the devil, not let my old nature mock all these things, not let the world mock me and then retreat in horror and embarrassment, but continue saying, my Father loves me, therefore I can continue to serve. Not let my old nature mock all these things, not let the world mock me and then retreat in horror and embarrassment, but continue saying, my Father loves me, therefore I can continue to serve.